But we will allow people to, Jeannie will explain in a minute that, you know, you will not be muted forever on the call. It's just during Phyllis's talk mostly.
All right. Welcome, everyone. This is a joint call for Progressive Democrats and United for Peace and Justice. The topic is Syria. And our special guest this evening is Phyllis Bennis. Just to give people a little bit of background, Progressive Democrats of America is a political action PAC. We do work on issues that are in support of our political beliefs, and we promote candidates for office who fit those political beliefs. We have a C4 action arm called PD Action, People Demanding Action. And they are just adding to their website right now and adding some campaigns in the next few weeks, issues pertaining to end wars and occupations. End wars and occupations is the team that this call falls under. And I will be introducing you to our co-chairs of this team in a moment. In terms of how this call will run, everyone is muted except for our host and speaker. We will introduce our host, our guest speaker this evening, Phyllis Bennis. She will give a talk, and then people will be allowed to ask questions at the end of the talk. Phyllis is moving on to do a television interview immediately after this call, so we will be closing off all of the question and answer session at 9:55 Eastern Time. People will be welcome to stay and have other discussion after that, but Phyllis will need to leave, and if she needs to leave earlier, which anything is possible, we will accommodate that. But as for now, that is the current schedule. So first, before we move on, I want to introduce Matt from United for Peace and Justice, and he'd like to give you a few words. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, hi. I just want to first thank everyone who organized the call. Just to give you a little background on UFPGA, we were organized in 2002 when more than 70 peace and justice organizations from around the country formed a coalition to end the war in Iraq and oppose the war in Iraq. And over the past 13 years, we've grown to over 1,400 member groups around the world working on a range of issues, but dealing with mostly militarism, peace, and opposing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Since the election of Barack Obama and the economic crash, we needed to reorganize, and we went from having a huge coalition with a staff of seven to an all-volunteer network coordinated by people across the country. But in 2013, when the president started calling for war against the Assad government, we started hearing again from groups who had either disbanded or began working on other issues, and they were coming to us because they were looking for cohesion and some sort of movement coordination. And when that happened, we had hundreds of events organized within a week, I think, around the country. And I think we're starting to see that happen again today. So with renewed resolve, we continued with a volunteer staff, basically, until recently when I came on part-time. I've been organizing as a volunteer with UFPGA since 2013, when we had the largest global day of action against war in the world. Together, we're working to end war, oppression, and shifting resources to human needs to protect the environment and to promote sustainable alternatives. Lately, we were part of the Peace and Planet Mobilization, which was another coalition. We mobilized at the United Nations around the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference. And again, we have spoken recently at the United Nations First Committee meeting about when they're talking about war and weapons, which is what goes on at the first committee meetings. We were there to talk about a message for peace and ending militarism and taking money from nukes and working towards complete abolition. You can go to our website. It's unitedforpeace.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm going to be live tweeting as we're going through this right now. So if anyone's tweeting, look for our handle. It's United for Peace. And also, we're completely member-supported, so anyone who has the opportunity to make a donation to us, make a donation to the other organizations that are helping host this, we know it's mostly appreciated, and we can't do this without your help. The last thing I want to say before I turn this over is that there is a national call for action around Syria and human rights, and that's taking place on Human Rights Day, which is December 10th. We're calling for activists to take all sorts of action, including public meetings, vigils, sermons, nonviolent civil disobedience, contacting Congress and hosting meetings, and asking for other people that you're connected with in the mass movement to join us. I urge you to go to our website, unitedforpeace.org, to learn more about that right now. Thank you very much for the call, and I look forward to hearing this.
Thank you, Matt. And then Sally Weiss and Chuck Altman are co-chairs of our End Wars and Occupations team here at Progressive Democrats of America. And I wanted to give Sally and Chuck a moment just to give a brief introduction before we begin with our speaker.
Hi, this is Sally Weiss. We have these PDA calls every month. If you want to become a part of the End War and Occupation team of PDA, just go to the PDA website and join up with the End War and Occupation team. As you just heard, UFPJ has a website. You can do a lot of things on that. And our speaker, Phyllis Bennis, has a very good website herself. And Phyllis asked me tonight, she probably will say this herself, but she has a new book out. Very relevant. It's called Understanding ISIS and the New Global War. And I welcome Phyllis, and I welcome all of you. Chuck?
And this is Chuck from Detroit, and I just wanted to welcome everybody as well. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And without any further hesitation, since we have very little time, I would like to introduce Phyllis Bennis and thank her very much for being on this call tonight. So, Phyllis, I'll turn it over to you right away.
Thanks very much, and thanks to all of you, to PDA and UFPJ and all of you for being on the call. Let me just say on one logistical thing, I will be going on the show tonight, but not till 10:30. So if we want to have an extra 10 minutes or so after, you know, go until 10:10 or whatever, that's still fine. So it's a little more flexible. So what we're going to talk about a few things tonight about the overall global war on terror and Paris and the failure of military strategy and the refugee crisis, all in about, I'm going to try and do this in about 20 minutes and then open up for questions so we have time to have some real discussion. We're looking, obviously, as you all know, at a real intersection of global crises. This really is a new global war on terror, even though it's currently led by the U.S. militarily. We now have France and Russia, Syria, Iran, all playing a role inside Syria, mainly military. And yet, with this increasing militarization, increasing levels of bombing, etc., this global war on terror is still failing to stop terrorism. What we saw Friday night in Paris, what we saw Thursday night in Beirut, what we saw 2 weeks before that in Ankara, all of these are examples of why you can't use war against terrorism. It simply doesn't work. I think it's important for us as peace activists to recognize that the events in Paris the other night, as horrific as they were, didn't, quote, change everything. ISIS attacks against civilians had happened in a number of other places, in Afghanistan, in Baghdad, as well as in Beirut and Ankara and elsewhere. I do think we should acknowledge that for those of us in the U.S. and for our colleagues in Europe, this one hit home harder. That's not surprising. There was a very good piece, by the way, by a former IPF colleague of ours, Jeanne Kay, writing in Foreign Policy in Focus today, who talked about the familiarity of Paris for many Westerners and why that familiarity itself can be used to broaden our empathy and our understanding of what others have gone through so much more frequently, so much more dramatically, and so much more consistently than what we in the U.S. and in Europe have faced. Additionally, I think there's an important point to be made about the events in Paris beyond the immediate horrific human cost and the need for human solidarity in response. We do have to recognize that there are worse consequences when Europeans, who are more likely to be white, are the victims of crimes like this. The consequences are more severe than if the victims are black or brown. And that is that the possibilities, and we're seeing it already with the French initiative militarily, the consequence is likely to result in a massive war in which a lot more brown people, in this case, are going to be killed than the original number of people who were killed in the terrorist attacks. That's what we saw after 9/11 in the United States. That's what we're seeing potentially in France and in Europe right now. We also have to recognize that the fact that ISIS is as violent and as horrific in their up-close and personal use of violence, that doesn't change the reality that using war, responding to a massive crime, a crime against humanity, with another act of war, we can't assume that will work just because ISIS is as violent as it is. Because at the end of the day, you can't bomb terrorism out of existence. Terrorism survives war. We've seen that just in these recent days. We've been at war against terrorism for almost 15 years between Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, across the region, Syria certainly, and it doesn't work. Terrorism has survived all those years of war, but hundreds of thousands of people did not survive, have been killed, and thousands more will be. So that's, I think, the framework we have to use when we look at these horrific events in Paris. Just one sort of parallel example. In the first 14 months of the U.S. war against ISIS that began in August of 2014, the U.S. carried out 7,900 airstrikes in that first just over a year. The group Air Wars in the U.K. did a study, a much more in-depth study, of just 52 of those airstrikes. They picked out 52 of them and found that just in those 52 airstrikes, at least 459 non-combatants were killed, more than 100 of whom were kids, were children. So the consequences of these wars, the consequences of the war in Syria alone, involves over somewhere between 11 and 12 million people that have been forced out of their homes, 4 million of them who have crossed the borders out of Syria and are seeking refuge either in Turkey or Lebanon or Jordan, or trying to get desperately into Europe. There's been about 250,000 people killed just in Syria. And one thing that I think we don't often think about just in terms of looking at the humanitarian consequences of these wars is the question of who gets left behind. There was an extraordinary story a few weeks ago from an Iraqi doctor who was working in Baghdad. She's a pediatric oncologist working at one of the main hospitals. And she told this story how she had wanted to flee but felt she couldn't because she had too many patients and there were no other pediatric oncologists that could take her caseload. So she stayed, and she said what happened is when people started to leave, people I knew, friends, colleagues who did leave, I would get desperate phone calls, whether they were stuck in a refugee camp in Jordan or Turkey, or maybe they had gotten lucky and had made it to Europe somewhere. But they would call and they would say, my mother is still at her house and she broke her hip. Can you look after her? My father's house just got bombed. Can you take care of him? So suddenly this dwindling number of people in the country who have stayed behind because of their sense of obligation to their fellow country people are now being faced with having to take care of their friends' parents as well as their own, because overwhelmingly the people who are leaving do not include the old folks. It was something I had never really thought about, and I think it's an important lesson for all of us when we think about what it really means when we talk about 4 million refugees, 7 million internally displaced, etc. So the failure of military strategy, we know what that means. These reports about the $500 million for Pentagon training that ended up with 54 soldiers, of whom half were immediately either gave up their weapons and defected or were captured or killed or simply ran away, leaving eventually just five U.S.-trained soldiers in Syria in this huge embarrassment. Of course, that's alongside a much larger CIA training exercise that has cost, we don't know how much because it's supposedly covert, although it's widely publicized. All of those campaigns have failed. They failed not because the training isn't good or because the soldiers don't understand it. It's because they don't know what they're fighting for. That's why people drop their guns and run away, when they feel that they have nothing that they're fighting for. This is what the U.S. is facing when it tries to create these artificial constructs of pro-Western, secular, anti-Assad, but not too much, because they really should focus on being more anti-ISIS, these militias with these very specific categories that just simply don't exist. And as a result, when the U.S. tries to create them, they fail. And as a result, the U.S. military strategy continues to fail. ISIS still controls a great deal of territory, although it has lost some territory in the last couple of months. But it still controls somewhere between 5 and 6 million people. The Assad regime continues its repression and its bombing. The U.S. is continuing to bomb. Russia is bombing. France is bombing. The U.S. is arming rebels who are shelling cities. So the Syrian population, the Syrian civilians, are sort of taking it on the chin from everybody. Those that claim to be their friends, those who claim to be their opponents, everyone is bombing, and all of them are fighting each other to the last Syrian. I'll get to this later, but essentially there are at least 8 separate wars now being waged in Syria, only 2 of which are actually among Syrians. The others all involve regional or global players, and the result is they're fighting these wars against each other all to the last Syrian. So I think that we have to look beyond the notion of how do we make a military response better, and it's particularly hard right now in the wake of the Paris attacks, where the claim is made President Hollande of France is seemingly channeling George Bush, saying that this is a moment we must go to war, this was an act of war, we will wage a merciless war against those who went to war against France. There is absolutely no reason to think that any escalation of the current military strategy is going to have any better results than it has had so far. The 15 years of failed military strategy is not likely to change. I'm going to skip over some of the stuff. We can get into it in Q&A if you like, on the reasons for continuing the global war on terror, some of the questions around regime change, around oil, around Israel, around regional pressures. I'm not going to get into all of that. I will just say one other thing. Two things. One having to do with the cost. The U.S. cost, just for the war against ISIS that began in August of last year, just so far has been $6.25 billion. Just that part of the war. That's not counting the escalating wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere. This is specifically for the so-called war against ISIS. The other thing I wanted to mention also on cost is this: is the need to challenge this notion. Nobody wants war. Nobody benefits from this war. We all want to end the war. Absolutely not true. Those who benefit, and the old saying, who benefits? Cui bono. This is what we have to look at now. Those who benefit are the CEOs and the shareholders of the major military contractors and the major military producers in the United States. They have been making a killing, in all senses of the word, on the continuation of these wars. And we cannot deny the role of their lobbies in pressuring Congress. One of the smartest things that the military-industrial complex ever did early on in its creation in the early 50s and into the mid-50s and early 60s was to create an infrastructure of production across the country in which virtually every single congressional district, all 435 congressional districts, have some kind of production outfit that is helping to produce bombs or bullets or guns or planes or whatever, some kind of military something, so that when it comes up in Congress to get rid of the XYZ program, say the F-35 bomber, for example, that the Pentagon itself says they don't want, it's virtually impossible to get enough people to vote against it because everybody in Congress has some little production facility where there are a dozen jobs or 100 jobs or maybe 1,000 jobs in their district making some small part for that plane. So that whole question of who benefits, who wants this war to continue, remains very, very important. The war continues partly because at the public level, George Bush created an assumption, and it's been followed by President Obama, that says the choice when there are massive human rights violations, or in the case of these terrorist attacks, massive crimes, that the choice is either we go to war or we let them get away with it. We go to war or we do nothing. That's never true. There is never the choice only of war or nothing. And we have to really get past that understanding that there's nothing in between. What we used to call the CNN factor, what now might be called the Twitter factor, very much plays a role here. We saw this in 2014 when the Obama administration, despite what was clear reluctance to engage directly at that time, gave in to the public pressure to, quote, do something at a moment when there was a serious human rights violation underway, when the Yazidi, the Syrian Kurds, were trapped on Mount Sinjar, and the U.S. said, well, we have to do something. All we can do then is military. Because in recent years, of course, U.S. economic and cultural and diplomatic and negotiating and all the other arenas of power for the U.S. have diminished. The only one that remains as powerful as ever, the only one that remains uncontestable by anyone else in the world, is military power. So anyone in the U.S. who's trying to figure out what does it mean to say we should, quote, do something, is going to say we should do something military, because that's where our strength is, and that's what we've been able to do, and that's what has continued to fail. So looking just briefly at ISIS, who is this enemy that we're fighting against, those of you who have talked to probably anybody have heard the line that has become popular that says ISIS was created because Obama pulled the troops out of Iraq, and everybody knows that's not true. What is true is that ISIS is a very immediate and direct result of the Bush administration invasion and occupation of Iraq. It's a very different scenario. It was created not in 2011 when Obama began to pull the troops out of Iraq, but rather in 2004 when certain leaders, including al-Baghdadi, got out of a U.S. jail where he had been held and began creating what was then one of many Sunni-based militias that were challenging both the U.S. occupation and the Shia-dominated government in Baghdad that the U.S. had installed and was continuing to arm and pay and support. So in that context, the organization that was at that time called Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, it was seen as an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. It was in some ways the Iraqi franchise of Al-Qaeda. And it grew and became stronger. It was never the only one of these militias, but it was one of the stronger ones, one of the bigger ones. And during the civil war that emerged in 2005 and 2006, when the war against the U.S. occupation was becoming accompanied, if you will, by a parallel sectarian war between Sunni and Shia being waged across much of Iraq, very devastating civil war, what was then the Al-Qaeda in Iraq organization became much stronger, became also more explicitly religious, more explicitly sectarian, and played a major role in that sectarian civil war. When the civil war began to wind down, for a host of reasons I'm not going to get into, in around 2009 or 10, the role and the visibility of the organization began to diminish. It didn't disappear altogether, but it just became less visible. It resurfaced in about 2011, in the spring, in Syria, now across the border that had been imposed by British and French colonialists, Sykes and Picot, back in 1919 to 1922, after the First World War, when they were dividing up the region, deciding which of the two colonial powers would get control of what territory, and they were essentially creating these artificial constructs they called countries. And that border, that very artificial border between Iraq and Syria, was put in place at that time. In 2011, the militia that had been born and emerged in Syria crossed the border, originated in Iraq, crossed the border to emerge in Syria in the context of the chaos that was resulting from the repressive, militarized response of the Assad regime to what began as a nonviolent political protest that was part of the Arab Spring. So that was the kind of reemergence of ISIS. It went through a number of name changes. I'm not going to go through that either. For those of you who haven't seen it, by the way, the book, Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, is done as frequently asked questions. So one of the questions, of course, is why do they have so many names? And it goes through kind of the history of the various names, why it changed their names, and that sort of thing. But that's sort of who they are. Now, I'm not going to go through all of either the religious or the political role that they've played. We can, again, touch on some of that in the Q&A. But I want to just go through briefly two more points, one about the current situation, the current escalation, and then secondly about the refugees. And then we'll open it up. So the question of escalations, which are now underway, the French joining these airstrikes, although much more for the purpose of political posturing than having any real impact on the ground so far, except for the danger in Raqqa, the city that ISIS has claimed as its capital, where the French have been bombing very intensely in the last 48 hours or so. The problem, of course, is that while ISIS has claimed Raqqa as their capital, it remains a large city of somewhere between 250 and 300,000 people. And it's a crowded city, so any bombing of that city is almost guaranteed to have significant civilian consequences. There have been public calls in social media from civil society organizations in and around Raqqa urging caution from these airstrikes, saying, not everybody here is ISIS. We're ordinary people who live here. Please, please be careful. Don't bomb us. So it's a very dangerous moment. It's also taking place at a moment when the potential for new negotiations is moving forward for the first time. The first time that the U.S. has stopped its opposition to Iran's participation in those negotiations, something that was one of the main reasons that earlier efforts by the UN in 2012 and 2013, those efforts failed for a number of reasons, but one of the big reasons was that the U.S. refused to allow Iran to be at the table. And when you have a major player who's responsible for arming and training and supporting one side, and you say, well, they can't be there because we don't like them, you're pretty much bound to fail, as they did. The Iran nuclear deal has opened up a number of new possibilities that remain very, very important. It's one of the most important aspects of that agreement, aside from the sort of broad question of the victory of diplomacy over war. It's also made possible the potential, at least, for some new serious diplomacy on ending the war in Syria from the outside. That doesn't mean that the internal civil war will be resolved, but it does mean that if it works, if this new process going on in Vienna goes forward, it could lead to a ceasefire and potentially maybe an arms embargo on all sides, which would mean that even though the Assad regime and internal opponents continued fighting for some period of time, they would quickly be unable to continue because they would not have the access to the flood of arms that have been there in this recent period. So I think that the escalations, the most optimistic view is that the escalations are going forward because anytime you have military powers about to engage in negotiations, they're likely to expand and escalate their military actions in the interest of making sure that they have the strongest position when they go to the negotiating table. On the other hand, there have been some interesting compromises indicated at the UN. Both Putin and Obama made important compromises. Putin said what prevented a complete takeover of Syria by ISIS was, quote, the Syrian state and its military. He didn't say the Syrian president and his military, which was a good indication that the concern of the Russians is maintaining the Syrian state, not doing what the U.S. did in Iraq when it overthrew the entire state apparatus, dismantled the military, and left chaos in its wake. Obama referenced the need for compromise. He said there will be compromises required. And he referenced what John Kerry had said a few days earlier, where he said Assad doesn't have to go on day one, not even on month one. So it was kind of compromising on both sides of what it would take to reach agreement between these outside forces. Now, obviously, a negotiating process that excludes the Syrians themselves is not ultimately going to solve the problem. But it can solve the crucial problem of what is maintaining this war, what is maintaining the access to weapons on all sides, etc. So that's what's, I think, optimistic about the Vienna talks. Everybody then will have to be at the table. Everyone in Syria, including the civil society movements, the women's organizations, all of the nonviolent protesters who incredibly bravely have continued to fight back against the regime and against outside forces, and have suffered enormously in doing so. Finally, on the question of the refugees, the Paris crisis, of course, has made the refugee crisis far worse. It is important for us to keep remembering that the refugee crisis in Europe is real on the one hand. There's somewhere around 750,000 to 800,000 Syrian refugees that have crossed into Europe, but there are far more. There are millions of Syrian refugees not in Europe, but in countries surrounding Syria itself, those who are facing horrific conditions but don't want to go unless it becomes absolutely necessary later, because ultimately they want to go home. These are people who are hoping that the war will end and their towns will not be completely destroyed by U.S. or other bombing, so that they will be able to go home. So when we talk about the refugee crisis, we have to keep in mind that it's not primarily a European crisis. There was here a very important quote from the Federica Mogherini, the European Union's foreign policy chief. She said, and I quote here, "This is not just a European crisis, it's a regional and global crisis. If you look at the number of Syrians, you have 8 million internally displaced people still in Syria and 4 million in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. You have something like 350,000 refugees in Europe." This was several weeks ago. "One number tells us everything. The percentage of refugees of the total population of Europe is 0.1%. In Lebanon, it is 25% of the population. We have to put things in perspective." That was a very important statement. Now, of course, after Paris, everything has become more complicated. The right wing has taken this and is running with it on the grounds that somehow the Syrian refugees who are running to escape both U.S. and Russian and other bombing and the regime's bombing and ISIS terror are somehow responsible for the ISIS attack in Paris. And as a result, the crisis is escalating enormously. The political call, one of the things I was going to raise tonight, was the importance of people calling members of Congress, demanding support for the Graham-Leahy bill, which would have called for $1 billion in additional resettlement assistance, taking up to 100,000 refugees in the next 2 years. A modest bill, but it was an important first step. The problem is, as of just a couple of hours ago, Graham just backed out of the bill and says there needs to be a hiatus on Syrian refugees. So he's pulling out. Much of the anti-immigrant efforts are rising right now, not just in Congress, but also in the states. There are, again, as of just a couple of hours ago, it might be more already, something like 26 governors have already said that they will not allow Syrian refugees in their states. Now, of course, they have no legal right to do so. They have no control over the federal program allowing in refugees, and no governor or state agency can legally stand on the border of their state and refuse to allow in anybody. But that doesn't mean that they don't have the power to both use the bully pulpit to exacerbate anti-Arab racism, Islamophobia, xenophobia, anti-immigrant hysteria, and all of those things, and just make life very, very difficult for any refugee that does end up in their states. So we're facing the kind of right-wing backlash that we were seeing in Hungary and in other parts of Europe in recent weeks. So it's a disastrous moment right now, and it's changing by the hour. Finally, just beyond the refugee stuff, and I really do urge people to move on this. We'll see what's going to happen with the Graham-Leahy bill. We need to support more resettlement. There's FCNL and others are pulling together organizational statements that will be used for some of that lobbying. You can contact them. But we also need to be broadening our opposition to the military response to the Paris attacks overall. We've got to continue to repeat that militarism will not work to end terrorism. Terrorism survives war. People don't. That's, I think, what pushes us forward. We've had 15 years of war against terrorism, and yet we have Paris, and yet we have Beirut, and yet we have Ankara. So it's clear that war doesn't work to end terrorism. Our job is to convince those in power that it doesn't work. Let me stop there, and we can open up for questions and whatever.
Thank you so much, Phyllis. It was a wonderful commentary. What I would like to do now is to let people know how to participate in the question and answer session, because everyone is muted. For people who want to ask a question, on your phone, press *6, and that will put you into a queue, and I will be able to unmute you so that you can ask a question. And you can start doing that immediately, and we'll take a stack in there. If your name does not come up on a caller ID, please just be conscious of listening for your being unmuted, because I won't be able to call you by name. Okay, Phyllis, I'm going to open up the first caller.
Okay.
Thank you, Phyllis. This is Janet Wheel of Code Pink National Staff, and we were discussing this on our staff call at quite some length today. We want to know in Code Pink, what action can people take on the street or in the real world? We want to move beyond people signing a statement of sympathy or other online actions to what people can do in public.
Okay. Are we going to take a few, or should I just take them one at a time?
We'll do them one at a time, so go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a complicated question, because it's not easy to say, well, we should be organizing big demonstrations or something. I don't think we can get big demonstrations right now. So we need to think what we can do that will educate and advocate with smaller groups so far. And I think it's on two arenas. One that I mentioned is on the refugee question. For the moment, I think pressuring members of Congress, and that means going back to their offices, harassing their staffs to take this seriously, looking at the Graham-Leahy bill. Maybe it will be called just the Leahy bill, but some version of that. The other thing that I think is going to become really important, and we should be looking at this in the next day or two, is campaigns at the state and citywide level. As I said, the anti-immigrant campaigning is going on right now primarily at the level of governors and mayors. It's mostly political posturing. They're gaining enormous, and the Republican presidential candidates. There's been some extraordinarily racist statements made. The stuff from a couple of them have said that only Christian refugees, Jeb Bush said this, and Ted Cruz, that only the Christians should be allowed in because they're not likely to be terrorists. President Obama actually pushed back against that very powerfully this afternoon, which was quite good. But the model that we had in 2003 and 2004 that some of you will remember that was called Cities for Peace, which brought mayors and city council representatives to pass resolutions and sign proclamations saying for various reasons why there should not be a war in Iraq. We can do the same thing for refugees. We welcome refugees, particularly, I think, as the governors turn against refugees, mayors of bigger cities are a likely possibility to welcome refugees to their cities. So those kinds of campaigns, I don't think it'll necessarily be in the street. It'll be working with people, with their local representatives in the city council or perhaps in the state assemblies, but at those local and statewide levels to push back hard – against the racism and Islamophobia inherent in these anti-refugee positions. More broadly, the question of opposing a military response to ISIS. This is being used now. The debate is how far to go. Should we have boots on the ground or not? That's really the only debate. Nobody is saying we've had military responses for 15 years and it's failed. It's time to start something else. So again, I don't know what tactics. Code Pink is always good at tactics of being very creative, and I think we have to do some creative things. I don't know what those actions will look like, but I think the issue they should be focusing on is this notion that terror survives war, people don't.
All right, thank you. Okay, we're going to go to the next question.
That might be me. Okay, my name
yes.
is Joyce. My name is Joyce Rowitcher. I live in Connecticut. I'd like to ask Phyllis, please, what do you think is the role of Israel throughout this regional disaster?
Yeah, Israel's role has been rather counterintuitive. They, of course, on one level have always supported the overthrow of regimes throughout the Arab world as kind of a principle, but on the specifics, it's very questionable whether they actually would prefer to, and particularly right now with the rise of ISIS, I think that the more sane voices in Israel, which means basically the military and intelligence leadership, not necessarily the political leadership, who are posturing for their own political purposes, but the more strategic thinkers of the Zionist movement in Israel, I think recognize that the Assad regime, both father and son, have been very helpful to Israel over the years, and that it's for that reason that they have not particularly targeted those regimes. There's been a few Israeli military strikes in the context of the Syrian war. In each case, it appeared to be against arms shipments that might have ended up with Hezbollah, which Israel does see as a major enemy in Syria, where those fighters from Lebanon had joined the Assad forces. But the Assad regime itself, of course, has been very helpful to Israel, going back to the 1976 attack on Palestinians at Tel Azatar, since 1967, keeping the occupied Golan Heights pacified, preventing any kind of a serious uprising there, keeping the level of violence very, very limited on the border, keeping the border quiet. So it's been the regime has been very useful to the U.S. I won't go through all of that, but the Israelis have made good use of that unofficial partnership with Syria, and particularly now where the almost inevitable result of regime change from outside in Syria would be a takeover by very dangerous extremist forces. I think the Israelis are not in favor of that. So they're remaining quite quiet, as we've seen. Their focus still remains on Iran. Iran remains their primary target. So that the question of what impact they have, one aspect of it is that they have their opposition, and Netanyahu's opposition in particular, to the Iran nuclear deal has weakened the ability of U.S. policymakers to broaden that deal into something that has even greater potential that I was speaking of earlier.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're going to go to our next question.
Oh, hello. Phyllis, this is Salim Lone. I knew you at the United Nations.
Oh, yeah, I remember you.
I'm from Kenya, yeah. And I'm back. I'm in the U.S. now. But just to let others know, I was a spokesman for the United Nations in Baghdad in 2003 when the bomb went off, killed Sergio and 21 others of us. And I write a lot on this for The Guardian. So the reason I listened in today, Phyllis, was I think I know a bit about the subject, but I wanted to hear you. And you did not disappoint. I mean, you said so many interesting things that I was not fully aware of. So thank you very, very much. I just want to make a very quick point and to hear your response to that. You focused on the causes of the very militaristic U.S. Attitude, the Western attitude, and the U.S. in particular, on the military-industrial complex, which is absolutely true. But you didn't give a political rationale for the war. And in my view, I think the broader goal of all this, of militarism in the U.S. and the West, is actually Iran, to weaken Iran. And Syria is one of the first steps from the Western perspective, which is why they want to overthrow Assad, the only person who could have possibly kept the state together in the face of all this terrorism. So when you said now that Israel actually was not keen to overthrow Assad because of its previous usefulness, I'm just not just so sure, because Israel is so determined on the issue of Iran that I think for them, Syria is a stepping stone. So just your views on that.
Yeah, no, thanks for that, Salim. It is an important point. I think it's a factor, and I think there is certainly a faction in the Israeli elite that would go after the Assad regime in a minute for those political reasons. I think it's more the strategic operatives in Tel Aviv that understand that that would not be in their interest in terms of their own expansionism, their own militarism, their own dominance, and their own ability to keep the pressure on the Palestinians, maintain occupation, maintain apartheid, would be curtailed under those conditions. I think for the U.S. it's slightly different. The U.S. There's the neocons. There's other political forces that mimic much more closely the Israeli view. But I think the dominant position in U.S. national policy-making circles now is to recognize that the Iran nuclear deal did represent a major shift in regional power, and that there's a real opportunity now for realignment, and that it's not going to look like a U.S.-Iran collaboration directly, but it could well look like a kind of alliance of convenience, which could be of significant value to both the U.S. and Iran. Israel, in that context, becomes a spoiler, and I think that's what's really at the root of the supposedly personal antagonism between Netanyahu and Obama. Israel has been a spoiler in preventing the maximizing, if you will, of the value of the Iran deal.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Good to hear from you, Salim. Thanks.
No, that's great.
All right, thank you. And we will take another question.
This is Jackie Tabasso. Am I in the queue?
Hi, Jackie.
Yeah, hi. This is Jackie Cabasso. I'm with Western States Legal Foundation in Oakland, and I'm a national co-convener of United for Peace and Justice. And I'm also the North American coordinator of Mayors for Peace, and that's the hat that I'm wearing for this comment. I just came back last night from Belgium. I was in Ypres, which is the first city that suffered a chemical weapons attack in World War I, for a Mayors for Peace executive conference. And I just want to make two points of information. One is that when I was going to the airport from Ypres to Belgium, the Belgian European Belgian taxi driver offered the following opinion, which was not solicited. He said that if his doctor told him he had only 6 months to live, he would round up all of the unexploded ordnance from World War I that he could find and deliver it to the nearest mosque. I was really shocked by that, but it may represent a kind of common sentiment, which is why I want to share that. Which brings me to my second point, which is I think that, and Phyllis has said this, but we really need, as a peace movement, we really need to be attuned to the dangers that are going to be faced by all Muslims and people of Muslim descent in the United States or coming to the United States, as we did after 9/11, because I just reviewed some statements and stuff that we issued at that time. Regarding Mayors of Peace, Mayors of Peace's primary focus is on the abolition of nuclear weapons, but what I want to report is that at this meeting, all of the European mayors who were there and African mayors who were there stressed the need to broaden the public profile of Marriage to Peace and to reaffirm some of the goals in its original covenant, which includes addressing the plight of refugees. And that is reflected in the final resolution. And I have been participating in the Syria working group that I know a lot of people on this call are on, and have we've talked about drafting a sign-on letter for U.S. mayors to welcome refugees to their cities, particularly from Syria, and twinning that with calling for an end to supplying arms and funding the wars in the region. So I just want to report that this new resolution from Mayor Sarkis, I think, will be helpful in getting our U.S. members on board.
That's great. Those are great ideas, Jackie. Thanks. I think that the question of engaging at the city level, what I mentioned earlier, is it can be really important, and Mayors for Peace can play a really useful role in that. The outpouring of Islamophobia, anti-Arab racism is dangerously high and getting higher. So I think, you know, we do need to keep that as a central feature of all of our work against militarization of this war. It also means opposing how the war comes home, and it's primarily Muslim communities, Arab communities, South Asian communities, and those and immigrant communities writ large that pay the biggest price for that. So it's a really important point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And we will take another question. Caller?
Hi, this is me.
Go ahead.
This is Stephen. So you suggest that only negotiating with ISIS will solve this problem?
No, that's not what I said, and that's not what I believe. I said that we need negotiations with those who support all sides, including those who fund and arm ISIS, who tend to be in Saudi Arabia, using our weapons. At some point in the future, there might be somebody who talks to ISIS and actually negotiates with them, but that's not on anybody's agenda at this stage. What is on the agenda is negotiations among the powerful countries that are enabling all sides in this war, from Al-Qaeda, the Al-Nusra Front, and ISIS, through the various so-called moderate Islamic forces to the so-called secular forces in Syria, the Syrian regime, the various militias that are supporting the Syrian regime. All of these forces are armed and paid and trained by outside forces. And that's who will be at the table in Vienna, and we should absolutely be mobilizing in support of these Vienna talks as much as we did around the Vienna talks on the Iran nuclear deal. All wars ultimately are ended with negotiations and diplomacy. The question is how long the fighting goes on, how long the killing goes on before people sit down at the table. ISIS isn't going to be at the table anytime soon, but those who support and arm them probably will. Thank you for your question.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Stephen. Okay, next question.
Doris Kirby Neal calling from Lexington, Kentucky. My question is with Islamophobia and military responses reinforcing the ISIS narrative, what options are there for changing that our response so it doesn't reinforce the ISIS narrative and facilitate recruitment?
Well, I think it's a really important point. I think the way we challenge that is by keeping opposition to racism and opposition to Islamophobia central to our work in support of refugees and in favor of diplomatic rather than military solutions to the war in Syria. To the degree that ISIS can point to Americans writ large are hate us all, they hate Muslims, you know, that fits their narrative perfectly. To the degree that statements and protests and mobilizations involve Muslim organizations, are led by Muslim organizations and Muslim leaders, take firm stances against Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism, it undermines the ISIS position. So those two things really go together, and they and both become very important for our work.
I do.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to another question.
Yes, this is Mary Frances with Americans Against the Next War, and I wanted you to speak to a couple of groups. Maybe the Saudi Arabians. I understand they had a role in supplying sarin a couple of years ago, 3 years ago maybe, and also the American neocons, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Crystal, Cheney, Abrams, all of those folks who are constantly trying to get the American administration into another war.
Okay. Well, the Saudis clearly have played a major role in this war. Right now, they're not playing as big a military role directly in Syria because they're concentrating their military capacity on devastating Yemen, leading a so-called coalition against Yemen that has brought Yemen to the absolute brink of humanitarian disaster. The UN estimates now that 80% of the entire population of Yemen, already the poorest country in the Arab world, are dependent on food aid for survival. It's a disastrous situation that's getting very little attention in this country. That's where most of the Saudi direct military engagement is going. Financially, it's widely known that Saudi Arabia is the source, the single biggest source of foreign funding of ISIS. ISIS has other sources of funding that are somewhat bigger, including taxes and fees that they impose on the people that live under their rule, as well as oil in relatively small amounts. But they get a huge amount of money from Saudi Arabia. What's not as clear is how that money is coming, whether it's directly from the king, whether it's from other princes, whether it has the support of the royal family or does not, whether it's coming from government-supported institutions in Saudi Arabia, whether it's coming from wealthy Saudi individuals who are not tied to the government, all of that remains very, very murky. What is not so murky is that this is a very tightly controlled state, and it seems pretty clear to me that if the king and the powers that be within the royal family decided they wanted to cut off that funding lifeline to ISIS, they absolutely could do that. The fact that it's murky to the West doesn't mean that it's murky to them. The fact that they allow it to go forward is a conscious decision that they have made. So that's one of the questions of how far is the U.S. prepared to go to pressure Saudi Arabia, which can only happen by threatening to cut off its arms sales, not something that's going to be easy for all the reasons I mentioned earlier in terms of the military contractors who make their billions in contracts with the Saudis. The question of sarin, by the way, in my view, is still a very unresolved question. I don't think we know where the sarin has been coming from. The neocons are who they are. They play the same role they've played for years. They're right now not in power in major parts of the government. There are a few individuals who are, but they are unfortunately very, very influential as commentators. Fox News is filled with them. They fill the seats of the right-wing think tanks across Washington, and they have far more influence than they should. What is different now than during the Bush administration is that they are not running the Pentagon, the State Department, the policy shop of the Pentagon, etc. That's a very important distinction.
Thank you.
Okay, we will take another caller.
Thanks. David Goff from Connecticut. I just wondered if you could give us some reference towards since 9/11 and up until now, who has sort of documented what those terrorists want?
Yeah, it's a hard question because I think there's been there's different groups of people that are identified as terrorists in the West. I think that Patrick Coburn, I'm forgetting the name of his new book on ISIS, he's one of the best Western journalists based in the region in terms of his sources and his analysis. I think his stuff is very useful. I think that Vijay Prashad has done some very good work on this. There was a guy named, it'll come to me in a second, who wrote a long, quite influential piece in The Atlantic about the theological basis of ISIS policies, essentially, which I think was useful for those who want to know that. I think I'm cautious, and in my book, one of the questions is, you know, what do they believe? And I start it by saying, you know, we know some things about what their leadership believes. It's not at all clear that their followers necessarily have those same beliefs, and it's not at all clear that this is what motivates people that are moving to join them or to support them outside. So it's of limited understanding. But that was an important piece. The guy's name was Graham Wood. That's it. And it's a very long sort of analytical piece of the theological history of ISIS's theology.
In The Atlantic?
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any, can you make any synthesis from those articles as to one or two points that stand out as?
Well, the big difference between ISIS and, say, Al-Qaeda is, one, ISIS is much more millennial-focused. They look at end days and they're as something that's much more immediate, and their effort is very much focused on creating what they call a caliphate, a Muslim-run state, something that Al-Qaeda saw as something that would happen kind of in the future someday in the end times. It wasn't something that was in the here and now. For ISIS, that's the here and now. That's been the primary goal. The attacks abroad, like this attack in Paris, if it was indeed led by the central part of Al-Qaeda, of ISIS, as opposed to just somebody using the name ISIS because that's kind of who's out there these days, were secondary by far to, or even tertiary to, that interest of maintaining the building of the caliphate, controlling territory, controlling people. So that's a very different approach.
And the caliphate, in that description of the caliphate, do they distinguish between societal objectives versus, you know, their desires versus the West?
It's a very complicated thing. I can't really summarize all that, and I'm not an expert in
it. I just thought
it
was good to try to understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And we'll
maybe just
another
one more.
Okay, this will be the last question. Thank you, Phyllis.
Well, hi, Ms. Bennis. My name is Michael Stone. I'm in San Francisco, and I'm an activist here. About a year ago, you wrote an excellent article. I think it was something like What Obama Can Do to Defeat ISIS That Doesn't Involve Bombing. And
oh, yeah.
You had five years. Beg pardon?
I said, I guess he didn't read it.
Oh, exactly. You had five steps. You stated them very succinctly. And you've mentioned two or three of them here. But I wonder if it's not too much to ask you if you could just kind of state that, state those maybe four or five things that the government, that our government could be doing.
Sure, I can tell you the nine steps, eight of which are in my book in the last FAQ, which is what should our government policy be? If we don't use military, what should we do? So number one, first, do no harm. It's the oath that doctors take, the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, which means stop the airstrikes, stop killing people, stop bombing, stop the drone strikes. Number two, make no boots on the ground real. Withdraw the troops. Withdraw the ones wearing sneakers, too, even if they're not wearing boots. Get all of them out. Number three, stop sending these massive amounts of weapons, which all end up with extremists, no matter who we give them to originally. Stop violating our own laws. Implement the Leahy Law that says that it's prohibited to sell arms to any group, either military or subgroup of a military who have a pattern and practice of violating international law and human rights. That means stop selling it to the Saudis, etc. That's a really hard one. That's probably the hardest of all of them. Number four is an easy one. Overturn the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project in the case in the Supreme Court that makes it a federal felony facing 20 years in prison. I actually thought it was 10. It turns out it was 20. For things that include explicitly training, say, somebody in the PKK or somebody in Al-Qaeda or somebody, anybody on the anti-terrorism list of the U.S., if you train them in nonviolent techniques or you train them in how to access the U.N.'s human rights system, you are guilty of a federal felony with 20 years in prison. That should be overturned. Number five, we need a new diplomatic partnership to respond to the ISIS crisis that puts diplomacy at center stage and means engaging with Iran, expanding the Iran deal to really build on that new relationship. Number six, new UN-led diplomatic negotiations on both ISIS and the Syrian war, including what the UN is doing right now on creating local ceasefires. This is engagement with the international and regional powers that are backing and arming the various forces on the ground. Number seven, we need the UN to restart negotiations, what's now happening in Vienna, that ultimately will involve everybody being at the table, including civil society. Number eight, increase the humanitarian contributions that the U.S. claims they make more than anybody else, but they don't make nearly enough. We have 28% of the wealth of the world in this country. We should be paying at least 28% of what the UN says they need to take care of refugees, which right now is about $5 billion for the next year. We should be paying at least 28% of that. And then last, increase the economic pressure on ISIS, including preventing the oil companies from trading in ISIS oil, something that they're doing, you know, massively. So that's what our policy should look like without going to war.
Well,
that was a nice question for the end. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you all. We've got a lot of work to do.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
This is Sally Weiss from PDA and UFPJ. I want to ask Jeannie a question. How many people are still on the call? Can you tell?
We still have well over 150 people on the call.
Lovely people that are still on the call. So we'll just continue in this Q&A mode right now. And, you know, when you...
Thanks. So I'm going to get off, and I'll be on the Lawrence O'Donnell show on MSNBC
at
10:35.
All right. Thank you so much, Phyllis, for your time and for taking so many questions. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
And those who want to follow her, she will be on Lawrence O'Donnell in just 20 minutes. For those who would like to stay on the call, I'm going to make a couple of quick announcements. First, the recording of this call will be available by midnight tonight. You can find the recording of the call posted at www.pdamerica.org. That's for Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. There's a drop-down menu at the top where you can click on our issues. And towards the bottom of that menu, you'll see End Wars and Occupations. Click on that. And it will take you to the End Wars and Occupations page. And on the right-hand side, down towards the bottom, you will see where our calls are posted, and you can click there to listen to the recording. Additionally, we also will be sending out that recording for UFPJ to post, so we will have that to them as well. And for those of you who may not be familiar, we do letter drops to Congress and have lobbying efforts through our C4 arm, which is People Demanding Action at peopledemandingaction.org. So in terms of the actions that Phyllis outlined we could be taking, PD America and PD Action will be examining what we're going to do next in relation to the lobbying efforts, and we will be letting all of you know what our next action will be in relation to this, and we will definitely be working with many of the coalition partners who are on this call. And lastly, we certainly urge people who are on the call, if they were happy with what they heard, to donate. We are completely member-driven. We are a PAC, but we do not take corporate money. We do not take dark money. We have a limit on donations because we are a basic PAC. We work on the issues, and so any donations are very, very helpful and very, very much appreciated. So going forward, we're going to leave this call open for about another 15 minutes. We still have, as I said, well over 100 people on the call. Anybody who would like to make any questions, comments, or partake in a discussion in relation to tonight's topic is welcome. And so I'm going to continue to pick up people who are still in the queue for questions, if they would like to continue to ask those questions and or to make comments for discussion. Others are also welcome to get in the queue. And again, getting in the queue is star six. So I'm going to go to our next caller.
Hey, who exactly did I ask the question to since she's off?
Well, just kind of discussing this together.
Discussion. Go right ahead, and it will be more of a comment and discussion. So you're welcome to put out some comments in relation to this, and we can open up a discussion.
Okay, I see. Well, my name is William. I'm with Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I was wondering if maybe like anti-war groups might make a statement that since the U.S. and a lot of European countries have a role in the Civil Wars or whatever they officially want to call them, that we have an obligation to take in the refugees.
Good point.
I think it's definitely a good point and something we'll definitely be in we'll be discussing with various groups, including Iraq Veterans Against the War, since they are part of the coalition that works on this. All right, I'm going to go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Nancy Cohn from Boston. I'm with the International Committee for Peace, Justice, and Dignity, which used to formerly be the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. I'm actually headed down to Guantanamo next week, where there's going to be a peace conference, an international peace conference of over 200 people. And I'm really excited about being able to share the information that Phyllis so aptly shared tonight with us. So it's great. I initially put my name in so that I could find out, you know, how to get the recording of it to share with people there. But if there are other people from Boston on the call, I just wanted to let them know that there's a meeting tomorrow night from 7 to 9 in Roxbury at the First Church of Roxbury, resisting surveillance that's being done with the Muslim community and Workman's Circle, to really talk about, you know, being shoulder to shoulder and trying to stop what we know is going to be a lot of attacks on the Muslim community. So, again, if anybody else on the call is still from Boston, 7 to 9 at First Church of Roxbury at 10 Putnam Street. Thanks.
Thank you, Nancy.
Okay, we'll go to the next caller.
Yes, hi, this is Stephen Spitz with TDA in Falls Church, Virginia. And I wanted to raise with folks about the political implications of this, the events in Paris on the U.S. presidential race. And my main concern is that what's going to start happening, and has already started to happen, is the more hawkish candidates will get more attention and more credence and possibly more votes in the upcoming caucuses and primaries, because when you have a horrifying situation, people are attracted to who's tough and who's going to solve the problem and who's going to, you know, want to bomb more. And I really think that this has potentially going to empower people who are calling for political purposes for more retaliation, more bombing, more war. And that will also have, perhaps, a negative context in de-emphasizing domestic issues like the economy and jobs and health care and so on. So I just thought I would throw that out there, that I'm not sure what we all can do except, of course, talk about the kinds of things that Phyllis is raising and emphasize the fact that we need to focus on solutions other than military solutions in dealing with ISIS, but also we need to keep our heads clear that we need to address a whole bunch of other problems other than just a knee-jerk reaction to what happened in Paris.
Hello, this is Sally Weiss. I'd like to take the privilege of one of the hosts to say something back to Stephen Spitz. First of all, hi, Stephen. We know each other.
Hi, Sally.
And, hi. I think we just have to keep in mind that the peace movement, we might be small in proportion to the population, but I think we have the population of this country behind us, the silent majorities on our side, and we've had our own victories and small victories, as Tim Carpenter would have said, in the last few years when we helped avert the missile strikes on Syria. Was that 3 years ago, something like that? And the Iran deal, we consolidated. I just wanted to say one other thing, and that's that on the Syria call, which happens on Tuesday afternoons, we seem to be confronting the question of why is the peace movement not quite as motivated or cohesive right now as we were on the Iran deal. And I think that's why there's 125 or more people on this call tonight, because we're all asking ourselves that question. And I think we're going to find our answers.
Excellent. All right, we're going to go on to the next caller.
Yes. This is Mary Frances, and I have been reading about the gray zone. I understand ISIS is interested in creating, much like Bush, you're either with us or you're against us. You're either in the black camp or the white camp, and dividing into these two camps is what they want, and not people who would be tolerant, people who would be helping refugees, no matter whether they're what their religion or what, simply because it's a humanitarian thing to do. I'm wondering if any one of the administrators here has talked about this gray zone, and that the possibly the best thing we could do is what the Syria, what ISIS doesn't want, and that is for us to show compassion and create a larger gray zone, not your with us or against us attitudes.
Good question.
Well, do any of our hosts have any comment in relation to in relation to that comment? Okay, well then I'm going to go on to the next caller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Go
Can
ahead.
You hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. I'm not quite sure how to ask the question, but it seems to me that our foreign policy and Israel's foreign policy with respect to the Middle East is the same, and that is just to disrupt as much as possible. There's no intent to resolve anything. It's just the intent is to disrupt as much as possible. And without any intent to solve any problems, and that it, that really we have intentionally started many of the conflicts, whether it's the Ukraine or whether it's in, you know, in Syria, and we have created ISIS ourselves. And if we were to somehow put them down, we'd create another one. How can we focus attention on the on that policy that is so united with Israel? And how can we focus on the people who benefit from this kind of policy? How can we draw attention to them?
I think that's a difficult question in terms of it's something that we've been doing for a very long time, but it seems to disappear under the radar. So I think that's probably for all of our organizations.
Well, but we got some very good suggestions tonight from Phyllis, and I think we all have our own ways, and in a way, we're, I think the part of the theme of what Phyllis was saying about action was individually, Jackie Colasso brought up about mayors for peace, cities for peace. We can do those things, and see, I think I took down your name. Maybe not. Who just asked the question? You get it, and just make sure that other people around you get it, and maybe let's get some refugees into some cities in America. That was one suggestion tonight. Any other host is welcome to talk besides Jeannie and me.
Yeah, this is Jackie Cabasso again. Am I unmuted?
Yes, we hear you.
Just two things. I wanted to respond to the person who raised the question about the gray zone, who said that creating compassion would create an even larger gray zone. And you know, I have been thinking about this all day, and I don't know how to make this actionable, except that it seems to me that Phyllis was clear, and everyone has been clear, that you cannot counter terrorist violence with more violence. We all know, I mean, we all believe that more military action will create more violence. And so we have got to somehow present ourselves as a nonviolent resistance movement. Nonviolence is the greatest form of resistance to violence. And how we operationalize that is a big question, but I just felt like it needed to be said. Regarding the question of how to focus on those who benefit, a small part of this puzzle is the those who benefit from nuclear weapons. And I mention that only because there is a new report from POX, which is an organization in the Netherlands. It's called Don't Bank on the Bomb, and it just released the 2015 report, which documents, very carefully documents the corporations and banks who benefit from nuclear weapons. And so, for example, State Farm Insurance is an investor in nuclear weapons. And so we might want to just recommend that you can Google Don't Bank on the Bomb. I just want to mention that as a tool for our use. And in the case of Syria, the question of nuclear weapons has become very relevant with the United States and Russia, the two largest nuclear armed nations, you know, bombing different factions, you know, side by side.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to take another comment. And I think This is probably going to be the last comment we're going to take, and I want to apologize to those we have stacked in the queue because this apparently is a very popular topic this evening. But we're going to take one last caller due to the time constraints that we have on our recording.
I'd like to know when and where she will be speaking on TV tonight at 10:30.
It's
simple
MSNBC.
Question.
Where is that?
The Lawrence O'Donnell Show.
And what network is that on?
MSNBC.
Lawrence O'Donnell Show?
On MSNBC, yes.
Thank you very much.
And I think we probably should curtail this in honor of Phyllis, our speaker. I'm always interested in communication after these sort of calls, and I hope Matt DeBleger is still on here. How do we correctly say in UFPJ, how do people ask a question? Is it info at UFPJ something or other?
If you want to send us a can you hear me, guys?
Yes.
If you want to send an email, it's info.ufpj@gmail.com. But also, you could follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get very up-to-date posts. And then also, we have on our website, unitedforpeace.org, there's a option in the corner to sign up for action alerts. Recommend you sign up for that.
And PDA has a Google group. It's earlier, Jeannie explained how you get on to the issue team part of PDA. And I hope I sort of assume that most people on this call tonight are part of UFPJ Activist Listserv, which is a service to all of us because we can talk to each other that way. And I really feel that the Activist Listserv very often is just seems to be it's too few people are using it. It's okay to have an opinion on either the PDA Google group or UFPJ activist listserv, and just the kind of questions and comments we're hearing tonight. I wish we had a lot more participation in it all, and I think we've had a wonderful time together tonight, and I think we will come together about Syria. So,
all right. Thank you.
I'll say good night.
All right. And then, just as a reminder to everyone who's still on the call, a recording will be available on PD America's website by midnight tonight. And again, you just go to pdamerica.org, click on Issues, and go to the End Wars and Occupations page. The recording will show up on the right hand of the screen towards the bottom. And in regards to the Google group that Sally Weiss referenced, directly across from where the call recording is to the left, there is a link there under how you can get involved. And you can click on Google group, and you can get yourself added to our Google group where you can have discussions about tonight's topics and any other topics, post news articles, and participate in the conversation that way. And what I'd like to do now is to turn this over to Matt from UFPJ and Chuck from PD America and have them close out the call for the evening.
Well, I guess I'll go ahead. I just want to thank everyone who was a part of the call. Thank you, Phyllis. Thanks to all the organizers and the people who were following us on social media and who received the email and decided to be a part of this. It's really up to you to be the leaders and to shape the debate around our country on how we deal with this crisis and really to create a will for peace in our own communities so that we can organize. A lot of people right now are going to be turning to you and people who they find knowledgeable about this, and it's really up to us to get that message out there and also to mobilize to create a viable peace movement that can push this forward. So I want to thank everybody, and I hope that we can mobilize. Please, again, check out our website for the actions going on Human Rights Day on December 10th, and I hope we are all getting ready to organize and hope to see you in the streets.
Chuck?
Okay, ditto. See everybody out in the streets.
Right.
All right, thank you.